From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, kicking a retail habit. CVS pharmacies announce plans to phase out the sale of tobacco products. We find out how customers are reacting.
I am a smoker, but I really want to stop. And I think the ease of access makes it hard.
I think it's a smart thing for them to do business-wise. I mean, they're clearly going more and more towards healthcare.
A UN report demands the Vatican exposes known child abusers within the Catholic Church. Find out why the US may have suspended its lethal drone campaign in Pakistan. And our Sochi Winter Olympics correspondent investigates the record-breaking budget behind the Games.
I am Anya Ardaeva in Sochi, where the Russian government has spent more than $50 billion preparing for the Games.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The United Nations has severely criticized the Vatican for what it calls systematically allowing clergy to rape and abuse thousands of children. The Vatican, in response, has said the UN has interfered. Nick Harper reports from UN headquarters in New York.
In the report from the UN Human Rights Committee that looked into the practices of the Holy See, the authors urged the Vatican to make its records on paedophiles public. The report denounced the clergy who had, quote, concealed their crimes, and also severely criticised the overall code of silence within the church. The report said by transferring known sex offenders to other parishes, the church had placed children in many countries at high risk of sexual abuse. As a signatory of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, the Vatican is bound to upholding the basic human rights of children, something the UN and many outside the church feel it clearly hasn't done. This report once again puts pressure on Pope Francis to act and commit to promises he made in December to set up a commission to look into abuse within the church.
One of America's largest retailers is set to stop selling tobacco products. CVS Caremark will pull the products from the shelves of its more than 7,000 stores across the United States in a move that the White House is applauding. Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
The president and CEO of CVS Caremark announced the landmark decision in a written statement. Ending the sale of cigarettes and tobacco products, he said, is the right thing to do for our customers and our company. He called the trade in tobacco inconsistent with our purpose. President Obama himself is backing the move. He offered the chain congratulations for an announcement that deals another blow to the tobacco industry.
And gay rights activists across the globe are holding a day of protest against laws passed by President Vladimir Putin's government in Russia banning so-called gay propaganda. With the Sochi Winter Olympics due to start in 2 days, the protests are drawing more negative publicity to the event amid accusations of massive corruption, human rights abuses, and unfinished building work. Tom Barton reports from Moscow.
The protests aim to make Olympic sponsor companies, including McDonald's, Coca-Cola and Samsung, speak out over a controversial law passed last year in Russia. Accusations, arrests and prosecutions under the law have already begun. The legislation makes it a crime to provide information about homosexuality to under-18s. The law's poor phrasing and loose interpretation, say critics in Russia and abroad, effectively stops all gay rights protests. With protests in 19 cities around the world, gay rights activists say the law violates the Olympic spirit.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. U.S. officials say 1,200 people are under investigation over a military recruitment scandal during the Iraq War, involving the collection of illegal fees for hiring soldiers. Two generals and dozens of colonels are suspected of having been involved in the fraud, which could end up costing the U.S. government some $100 million. Nina Maria Potts has more.
The U.S. military recruitment fraud, details of which were revealed by two army generals at a Senate hearing, is said to have cost the U.S. government at least $29 million already. Soldiers, civilians, and retirees were allegedly paid between $2,000 and $7,500 to recruit family and friends into the army under the National Guard program, which was set up in 2005. Investigators allege that a number of fraudulent mechanisms were used under that program, in which the Army paid out more than $300 million for 130,000 recruits during the Iraq War. Among the allegations, that high school principals and also school counselors took money for recruiting students they knew wanted to join up.
The U.S. has curtailed missile strikes from drone aircrafts following a request from the government of Pakistan. The Washington Post reports the Obama administration denies there's been a significant shift on Pakistan policy. New York City police have arrested four people as part of an investigation into the death of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman. Two of those arrested were suspected heroin dealers, and 350 heroin-filled envelopes were found at the apartment. Millions of commuters in London are experiencing disruption, with tube workers carrying out a 48-hour strike in the capital. Severely limited train services have been running, as staff walk out in protest over planned job cuts and ticket office closures. And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The Vatican adopted policies that allowed priests to rape and molest tens of thousands of children over decades, just one of several devastating findings from a new United Nations watchdog report. The UN Human Rights Committee urged the Church to expose known child abusers within the clergy. In response, the Vatican insisted the Church was committed to defending and protecting the rights of the child. Earlier, I discussed the report with John Allen, Associate Editor of the Boston Globe, covering global Catholicism.
Well, it's damning indeed. Essentially, what the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child alleges is that the Vatican imposed policies and procedures that allowed the sexual abuse of children to go on, and that it fostered what the UN describes as a culture of impunity for the perpetrators of that abuse. And it's issued a host of recommendations to the Church, in effect, to clean up its act, including that all abusers should be immediately yanked out of the priesthood, that all Vatican records on abuse cases should be turned over to public authorities, that there should be a mandatory policy of reporting abuse allegations to police, and so on. So it is a comprehensive and quite stinging indictment of the way the Vatican has managed the Church's sexual abuse scandals.
So how has the Vatican responded to these criticisms and recommendations?
Well, in a statement today, what the Vatican said is that it is going to take the recommendations on child protection to heart. This report, of course, follows an appearance by two senior Vatican officials before the Committee on the Rights of the Child in Geneva on January 16th, where they tried to describe what they see as mammoth progress the Church has made in recent years in trying to fight this epidemic and vowed to continue to move the ball. So they said they're going to listen to that stuff seriously. What complicates the picture is that the UN panel didn't just restrict itself to comments on child abuse, but also recommended that the Church change its teachings on issues such as abortion, gay marriage, and contraception. There, the Vatican has said it's a non-starter and has accused the UN panel of being driven by an ideological line.
That's right. The notion of political correctness, I think I heard from one unnamed Vatican source. But the Vatican has already set up a commission to fight or tackle child abuse within the Church. Isn't that the case?
Yes. In December, the Vatican announced that Pope Francis had decided to set up a new commission on child protection to lead the fight against sex abuse, to try to promote best practices on the ground. And remember, there are 1.2 billion Catholics in the world. The Church is located in every corner of the planet. And the practice on this issue in, say, Germany or the United States isn't necessarily the practice in Bolivia or in Zimbabwe. And so this commission is going to try to make sure there's a uniform global standard.
Can any of the recommendations put forward by the UN Watchdog report actually be enforced?
Well, I think the single biggest case or complaint that critics will give you about the Church's response to these scandals is that while it's officially adopted a zero-tolerance policy, to date, there haven't been any consequences for bishops who fail to apply it. For example, there was a bishop in Kansas City who recently pled guilty to a criminal charge of failure to report and remains as the Bishop of Kansas City. And then the question critics will raise is, until there's accountability in cases like that, then what do these policies actually mean? Now, this commission will itself not have any power to crack heads, because that power belongs exclusively to the Pope. But it would be in a position, because it'll have the Pope's ear, to say to Francis, hey, this is a case in which you need to do something.
John, can you remind us of the extent of this abuse? Because this has stretched over decades and spanned continents.
Yes, that's right. In many cases, the acts of abuse we're talking about date back to the 1950s, 1940s, even earlier. And they do range all over the world, although it should be said that most of the cases we're familiar with come from Europe and North America, because that's where this scandal has hit the church the hardest. It has not yet arrived in many ways in other parts of the world, so there may be additional revelations to come.
John Allen, Associate Editor of the Boston Globe, covering global Catholicism. This is FSN Reports. The Affordable Care Act has been catapulted back into the political arena after a nonpartisan congressional report said the law could cost the US labour force over 2 million jobs. The Budget Office report claims the full-time US employment rate will slow as people turn down work to avoid losing federal health care subsidies. Republicans jumped on the report as devastating proof of the failure of the ACA, but the White House pushed back, saying the report showed the Care Act may not reduce the overall demand for jobs. White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, Linda Feldman, told me the findings are open to interpretation.
It's straightforward and it's not straightforward. This is a projection from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. And it's very important how this is described. If you say that the law will cost the U.S. workforce over 2 million jobs, that makes it sound bad. It makes it sound like 2 million Americans are going to get laid off. When that's not at all what the report says. What they're saying is that because the law is beginning to decouple health insurance from work, it actually allows workers a lot more flexibility. So, for example, somebody who would rather be working part-time than full-time can now do that and get his health insurance off of the government exchange, potentially with a subsidy, instead of being locked into working for an employer full-time so they can get the health benefits.
But that's not necessarily how congressional Republicans are interpreting the figures.
That's right. Their narrative is that Obamacare is a job killer, and here's the evidence from the CBO to present that. So as soon as the CBO report came out on Tuesday morning, you had a flood of reactions from both sides. You had Republicans saying, see, it's a job killer. And you had the White House, which I credit with being on its toes on this one, immediately coming back and saying, no, this is not eliminating jobs. This is all about worker choice. It's workers choosing to work fewer hours, and there will be fewer full-time equivalent workers in the workforce, but it's not because people are involuntarily losing their jobs.
But what this tells us is that the healthcare law as an issue for 2014 is very much in play already.
Absolutely. We're now getting ramped up for the November midterms. Control of the Senate is in question. The Democrats have it now. They are very, very eager to hold on to the Senate, as is President Obama. And Obamacare is going to be a big part of the Republican campaign against Democrats. And so if Republicans can convince enough voters that Obamacare is hurting the nation and hurting the economy, then reports like this could end up being damaging to the Democrats.
White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, Linda Feldman. Now, here in the US, the country's second biggest chain of pharmacies, CVS Caremark, has announced it's to stop selling tobacco products in all of its shops by this coming October. The White House cheered the move by CVS, and in a briefing on Wednesday, presidential spokesman Jay Carney called himself a reformed smoker and praised the decision.
We obviously think this is an important decision because of the impact that smoking can have on the nation's health and on especially American children.
The move will make it the first such outlet in America to take cigarettes off the shelf. CVS says the move will strengthen its position as a healthcare provider. The company has over 7,500 stores across the US, and one of them is right next door to FSN's office in Washington, D.C. So, our reporter Lorna Shaddock went out to see what CVS customers made of the decision.
Please select your language.
Well, I'm here at Farragut North CVS, right in the heart of downtown Washington, D.C., and I'm standing near the till where there are many packets of cigarettes, rows and rows of them, on sale to the general public. But at the other end of the store is the pharmacy section, an area which tends to promote healthy living to CVS customers. So it seems CVS itself feels there's an anomaly between those two sections of its shop, and its customers, the ones I've been speaking to anyway, seem to agree.
I think it's a very proactive decision because I am a smoker, but I really want to stop. And I think the ease of access makes it hard.
It's wonderful. It's good. It's a health store with, maybe they do the same with all the other stuff on the food.
I think it's a smart thing for them to do business-wise. I mean, they're clearly going more and more towards healthcare. We actually go there for flu shots and all that. So I did kind of think it was kind of ironic that they'd be doing more good health stuff and selling cigarettes. So I think it's just smart business for them.
I don't know why they would stop selling cigarettes at CVS. I mean, a lot of people smoke, so it would probably bring in some better business. It really doesn't bother me because what I smoke, they don't even carry.
I think it's fantastic. I think they're showing leadership in an area of public health, and it is only a good thing as far as I'm concerned. I'm a frequent shopper of CVS, but it will always be my first choice now.
I think cigarettes are awful things for your health, and that if a store is branding itself on overpriced medicines, they shouldn't also be selling what gets people sick.
I think cigarettes do more harm than good, and I think it's a good idea that CVS has stopped selling them because it'll save a lot more lives.
Lorna Shaddock in Washington, D.C. For a further look at what the move means for CVS's marketing and business strategy and the future of tobacco sales in America's pharmacies, FSN's Rebecca Hume spoke to George Anderson, editor-in-chief at Retail Wire, an online industry forum.
CVS, like some other companies, are really positioning themselves as health organizations. They're not just a pharmacy that has a front end that sells a bunch of products that you find in other stores. I mean, they're actively expanding their Minute Clinic business, and they're looking for their own niche within the healthcare industry, particularly with the opportunity that's being presented by the Affordable Care Act, where a lot more people will have access to health insurance and therefore health care than they have in the past. So they really see this as, maybe a short-term hit that they're going to take. I think that the $2 billion that they talked about is going to be equivalent in their 2014 fiscal to somewhere between 6 and 9 cents a share. But over the long haul, as a company that is in the health business, selling those products just seems to run contrary to their position within the marketplace.
Now, health experts are saying that it could put pressure on other drug chains to follow suit. Do you anticipate this happening anytime soon?
Well, I mean, there are other retailers that have already done it. Target, for example, a number of years ago stopped doing it, and they've got a fairly sizable pharmacy business. Wegmans, a supermarket chain the Northeast has stopped selling them, so they're not alone. A lot of the independent pharmacies have done that. I think that every company comes down to where they think they're in the best position to attract consumers into their stores, and I think that CVS has made the decision, based on where they're going as a company. You got to remember they're also in the pharmacy benefits manager business, that it's more consistent with what they're doing. I wouldn't be surprised if others followed suit. I mean, cigarette business in particular has been on the decline for many years, but it's still a sizable business in the U.S., as evidenced by the fact that, you're talking billions of dollars just for CVS alone.
Absolutely. I mean, I was sort of going to ask, I mean, what is CVS to the consumer? Is this really just an attempt to redefine its position here as a healthcare provider and obviously follow this trend where we're seeing the decline in cigarette sales?
Yeah, well, I think that you know, that there's a high level of trust with drugstores to begin with because of the role of the pharmacist in healthcare. And that's become more pronounced in recent years with the expansion of services. You know, I mean, you see today drugstores actively competing, you know, with doctor's offices for, you know, immunizations rather against, you know, against various types of diseases, the flu and whatnot. And you've seen the expansion into the in-store clinics, and CVS among all the chains has been the most aggressive in that particular area. So, you know, it just you know, just takes out some of the contradictions, if you will, in their positioning in the marketplace. And I think over the long haul, probably even shorter term than that, that they'll derive some benefit from this.
George Anderson, Editor-in-Chief at Retail Wire. Now, the Obama administration has allegedly paused its campaign of lethal drone strikes in Pakistan at the request of the country's government, which is currently attempting to hold peace talks with the Taliban. But legal experts and human rights groups have criticised the US for continuing its covert drone programme in Yemen and Somalia, where both militants and civilians have been killed without due process in recent months. The news comes as Congress prepares to give a lifetime federal court appointment to one of the authors of the legal memo that authorised the government to strike US citizens and foreign nationals, sparking a debate about whether those strikes violate the Constitution and international law. On Capitol Hill, our correspondent Alice Olstein has more.
Unnamed government officials told the Washington Post that the Obama administration has put its drone strike campaign in Pakistan on hold for more than a month, while the Pakistani government tries to establish peace negotiations with the local branch of the Taliban. It's the longest pause in the CIA's drone campaign since a six-week period in 2011, after an airstrike by U.S. forces killed 24 Pakistani soldiers and sparked a diplomatic crisis. Though the U.S. government has refused to confirm the allegations around the current situation, investigator Chris Woods said it squares with data from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which uses sources on the ground to track drone strikes.
There has been a steep decline in the number of recorded CIA drone strikes in Pakistan over the last year or two. And in fact, there haven't been any documented strikes at all in January, which does indicate that the administration is approaching Pakistan slightly differently from how it has done since 2009.
But Woods, who analyzed drone strike data for the Bureau for many years before leaving to do his own research, says this apparent pause in Pakistan has not extended to the other countries where the CIA strikes without officially declaring war.
And certainly in Yemen and Somalia, it's still business as usual. Despite in Yemen, in fact, the Yemen parliament recently voting for an end to drone strikes, nevertheless, the U.S. has the agreement of the present administration in Yemen to conduct counterterrorism operations. And unfortunately, a number of those strikes have resulted in what we think are significant numbers of civilian casualties. For example, in December, the bombing of a wedding convoy that included a number of local al-Qaeda affiliates, alleged affiliates, but unfortunately is also reported to have killed up to a dozen civilians who were simply traveling to a wedding.
President Obama said in a speech last May that his administration only allows strikes against al-Qaeda operatives who pose a continuing and imminent threat to U.S. persons, and only in cases where there is a, quote, near certainty of no civilian casualties. But many human rights groups say they've seen evidence to the contrary. Noreen Shah with Amnesty International says her organization's on-the-ground research in Pakistan uncovered some drone strikes in North Waziristan and other regions that they believe constitute unlawful killings.
We documented cases including the killing of a grandmother and a 14-year-old boy from drone strikes that we believe the U.S. government needs to be held accountable for. So we're asking the White House to come clean about these killings and to release information about all people who have been killed in drone strikes, and also to pledge to investigate the drone strikes that we documented in our work.
As human rights groups continue to battle the U.S. government in court for the right to see the legal memos authorizing the strikes, including a handful the government has admitted to carrying out against U.S. citizens living abroad, Congress may confirm the author of those memos to a lifetime judicial appointment. Last month, the Senate Judiciary Committee advanced the nomination of David Barron to sit on the First Federal Circuit Court. Barron was head of the President's Office of Legal Counsel during his first term and is reported to have written the legal justification for the drone strike that killed Anwar al-Awlaki and his 16-year-old son, who were both citizens of the United States. The full Senate is expected to confirm him to the post in the coming months. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Finally, tonight on FSN Reports, the stage is set in the Russian city of Sochi for the start of the Winter Olympics. And already at least one record has been set, with the Games to become the most expensive Winter Olympics in history. When Russia won its bid to host the Winter Olympics in 2007, Moscow said it planned to spend $12 billion on the project. Recent reports indicate the real price tag has topped the $50 billion mark. FSN's Anya Ardaeva is covering the Games in Sochi for us, and in her first report from the city, looks at how the money was spent.
In less than a week, the Olympic flame will be lit in Sochi, marking the opening of the Games, already dubbed the most expensive in history. The Sochi Games, according to the Russian President Vladimir Putin, are intended to showcase the new post-Soviet Russia to the world, and the price tag doesn't seem to matter. Alexander Zhukov is the head of the Russian Olympic Committee.
Sochi has had to start from scratch. We've had to complete all the construction projects in 6 years, including new stadiums, roads, power stations, airports, and hotels. And the distance between each stadium is the smallest ever. It's unprecedented.
For the past 6 years, the area around the beach town of Sochi resembled a huge construction site. It now boasts new state-of-the-art stadiums, roads, and hotels, providing 40,000 new rooms.
Construction of this new road and railway through the mountains to the ski resort of Krasnaya Polyana cost over $8 billion. One Russian magazine calculated that for that amount of money, the entire road could have been paved by a layer of black caviar.
Several opposition leaders, including anti-corruption blogger Alexei Navalny, accused the government of rampant corruption during preparation to the Olympics. On a website launched 2 weeks before the Games, Navalny said at least one-third of the money spent in Sochi was stolen. Vladimir Putin dismissed the claims, saying allegations of corruption were, quote, nothing but talk. Yaroslav Lisavolik is a chief economist of Deutsche Bank in Russia.
Nobody is hiding the fact that certainly in Russia the issue of economic efficiency, of fiscal spending coming from the budget, is a great challenge. If the private sector were to co-finance a lot of these projects, there would have been, less concern regarding the inefficiency of budget financing.
Lisavolik says the global financial crisis of 2008 has prevented many foreign companies from investing in Sochi due to lack of funds, adding that the Russian officials view massive Olympic spending as a long-term investment in the country's south. The Fish Stadium, for instance, which cost over $600 million to build, will be used as a training center for Russia's national football team. But it's not yet clear whether the southern region of Russia, home to 5.5 million people, will be able to make profits from all the other multi-million dollar winter sports facilities once the Olympic Games are over. Anya Ardaeva, Sochi.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us by emailing us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Thursday, we look at a new law that allows Afghan men to beat their wives. That's Thursday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Rebecca Hume and Rebecca Foster on the bulletin desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.